Your whole family's out. No bankruptcy. So again, these standards seem, by perhaps middle class or bourgeois values, to be logical, but they don't make sense for the people that they're trying to put into these new housing. So the selection criteria for the deserving poor, quote unquote, is too stringent. In fact, most poor people end up just being displaced and moving to other public housing. Now, in addition to this being just logistically problematic, it's also ethically problematic. Because essentially the ruling classes or the middle classes are determining what constitutes deserving, and those reflect their own values. No criminal record, no bankruptcy, no late rent payments, and whatnot. And some studies suggest that so few people end up moving into the new housing that it really doesn't have any effect in terms of sort of rehousing these poverty-stricken peoples. Now, it should also be noted that as Chicago's economy shifted during the course of the 20th century from sort of heavy industry to service industries, the character of its downtown has changed. And Cabrini Green now is adjacent to two of the wealthiest neighborhoods in Chicago, Lincoln Park and the Gold Coast. So essentially, the property values underneath those decrepit towers have increased dramatically in the past few decades. And it has to be noted that raising the public housing projects, relocating the undesirable poor, and constructing privately developed low-rise housing to accommodate the financially and socially better off is just another example of the continued hegemony of the ruling classes and the continued marginalization of the poor, a process aided and abetted, even if inadvertently, by government legislation and planners alike. So these programs like Section 8 and Hope 6 are meant to put these people in this housing, but in fact, that's not quite what happens. So what to do now? That's sort of the looming question. Clearly, the current trend points toward the privatization of low-income and public housing. But does this work? I've shown you many different examples of worker housing and also public housing that's being converted to market rate. Even if it's not being demolished, things like Stuyvesant Town and whatnot, they're not being torn down, but their financial structure is quite different. Proponents of privatization comment that non-government revenue is the only way to create an economically sustainable model for low-income housing. It's a pragmatic response to the perpetual deficits of most public housing authorities. And for the most part, these public housing authorities have operated under extreme financial duress, so there's some logic to that. And the proponents argue that privatizing it is a way to preserve at least some form of public housing, even if it's less units. But it does preserve some form of public housing. It does not end it. Now, critics, of course, argue that privatization, in fact, resegregates cities, since most poor residents can only relocate to other poor, usually black or ethnic communities. So it really only works to the benefit of the advantaged classes, who reclaim desirable, expensive inner-city land for themselves at the expense of the poor. So there's sort of, you know, shifting arguments on the side of privatization. There are some other solutions, though, that have been proposed as well. One is that the tenants themselves in the public housing project should organize, and that has happened in a few cases. One just a prominent case in 1972 in Kenilworth Parkside in Washington, D.C. In that case, the residents formed their own residence council. And one particular woman, who was a 25-year-old woman at the time and actually had five children, was living on welfare in this public housing project. She finally became so just incensed over, you know, the lack of hot water, the lack of heat, you know, all the crime and whatnot, that she ran and was elected president of this residence council, and she organized cleanup brigades where the tenants themselves would clean up the graffiti and the garbage and whatnot. She appointed safety officers to keep the hall lights on and the doors locked, which kept crime down. Negligent parents were reported to authorities, and children's school progress improved. So basically, she did all these things with the other tenants who were interested to improve their quality of life. And today, Kenilworth is entirely managed by an elected board of the residents themselves. And the result of that is that welfare dependency in the Kenilworth Parkside has decreased from 85% to 20%. People are being encouraged to get jobs. They've set up even like job programs. Crime is down 90%. Teenage pregnancy has been halved. So these major social benefits have come about because the tenants have organized. So it's not just an architectural problem. It's not just a matter of switching to low-rise or row houses. It's a social problem. And in this case, they've really managed to turn around their home. Now, the ultimate goal of this particular group of residents is to purchase their homes. They want to purchase the entire 26-acre site and actually purchase their own apartments, and which is interesting. I mean, it's in some ways another argument in favor of privatization. So there is some logic to the idea that if you have a personal ownership stake in your housing, you're more apt to take care of it. Some other solutions that have been proposed is that we should moderate our goals. The tall tower and the park housing projects are very ambitious. I mean, tens of thousands of residents are often housed in these tower and the park housing projects, And currently, architects are often doing more modest low-income housing projects, so maybe there's only 100 units or something like this. It's a little bit easier to keep a handle on the smaller projects, but of course the question there is, are they large enough or comprehensive enough to house the huge numbers of poor that need housing? So, they might work in small instances, but is it comprehensive enough across the board? That's sort of a question. Others argue that we should focus instead on legislation instead of architectural solutions or design solutions, perhaps new types of financing. So, for example, one of the concerns with Section 8 and Hope 6 is that it relocates individuals. Only these deserving poor that qualify are relocated. And many residents, when interviewed, that chose not to go into Hope 6 housing, they actually commented that they didn't want to be separated from their social network. So, you know, as poor as they are living in these public housing projects, they do have their own kind of social networks, and that gets broken up when you divide out individuals and relocate them and not the others. So maybe new legislation could relocate networks of people, not just individual people. So there's all kinds of ways we could tinker with legislation and whatnot. A fourth sort of thing to think about, and this is maybe a little bit more pessimistic, but we can see over the course of the talk today, for example, there's not really been a true development in public housing. We've gone from the low-rise tenement housing that were speculative. We went to the kind of high-rise cooperative housing, which was actually perhaps the best model. And we're going back now to speculative low-rise housing. So we haven't really had a development. We've only had cyclical change. And essentially today, we're still preoccupied with the same questions and problems that plagued Americans in 1900 and in 1940, privately financed reform efforts that are piecemeal and that privilege the affluent classes. So until our society really does a fundamental rethink about public housing, some propose that perhaps it's even irrelevant to debate solutions. For the most part, the underlying problem is that the culture in the United States does not particularly care about public housing. We privilege privately financed, single-family, owner-occupied housing. So it's an economic issue, and until that orientation changes, perhaps it's even doesn't matter, no matter what we do. Legislation, architecture, and whatnot, perhaps it's irrelevant. And I think lastly, for architects, we've talked a lot about financing, this kind of thing, legislation in the talk, but this is an architecture talk. And for architects, the question too becomes, does design even have a place in the debate surrounding the future of low-income and public housing? We've obviously seen that design changes, for example, from low-rise to high-rise back to low-rise, it hasn't had a significant impact on the social problems, which actually seem more cultural than architectural. So some architects are concerned that perhaps almost their own profession is irrelevant in the debate over low-income and public housing, which hopefully is not the case, but many different solutions, many different issues, many different concerns. Hopefully moving forward, we can come up with something better than we have in the past. Thank you.